to the Middle East now with Sebastian Usher, who's a BBC Middle East analyst, editor and reporter. Hi, Sebastian. How are you doing?
I'm good. Hi, Lynn.
Well, we've just been talking about Afghanistan with an Afghani journalist who fled to Canada earlier in the program. How is the UN responding to the continued crackdown on protests there?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
How is the UN responding to the Taliban's crackdown on protests?
The UN? The UN is always quite cautious in these ways. I mean, obviously, you look at the Security Council, Russia and China play a major role there. So unity in terms of taking a clear attitude towards the Taliban, I don't think really we're looking at the UN for that at the moment. And the UN's main problem, in a sense, is ensuring that the aid that Afghanistan still needs very badly, in fact, probably more so than ever now the Taliban is in charge, can still get through. I mean, there have been many warnings from various UN agencies over the past couple of weeks since the Taliban took over about that, saying that many aid outlets, hospitals, etc., are close to having to close down because of the uncertainty of the changes there. So I think that's the immediate concern of the UN about that. As you say, these reports about protests have been coming from various parts of Afghanistan about the Taliban acting, using some violence, at the very least shooting into the air to disperse protests. Reports that some people have been killed. Also journalists. There are journalists for one of the few independent Afghan media outlets still going, who've been displaying the scars that they've got from having been detained and beaten. So these are serious concerns. I mean, I've been looking really, to be honest, at the way that the other parts of the Middle East, Iran and the Gulf, have been reacting to what's happened in Afghanistan. Iran, if you go back more than 20 years, was almost at war with the Taliban. Since then, things have changed. Iran has been preparing itself for this takeover. In its media, it's been actually asking outlets there to tone down their language against the Taliban. I remember, of course, the Taliban are a Sunni group. They have carried out attacks against the Shia in Afghanistan on a number of occasions. But the Taliban have been making noises towards Iran that they are more inclusive. And Iran, perhaps, as I think several other countries in the region, although they may be not exactly best friends with Iran, but I think they're sensing that there is at least a diplomatic opportunity here. Iran is one. Qatar is another. I mean, Qatar played a role in the mediation between the US, such as it was, and the Taliban, which led to President Trump's decision to pull out the troops, which Biden then acted on. And Qatar has continued to play that role. It sent in the first aid to Kabul airport after the US had finished their evacuation. And they are holding talks, actually, in combination with Iran. The Saudis, the UAE, who were the only countries in the region to actually recognize the Taliban, albeit relatively briefly back when they were in power at the end of the 90s. Again, they're holding back. They're being very prudent in their response. But again, I mean, they may be able to lever this for their own diplomatic gain in terms of their ties with the West, with other countries, that they have an in a sense. And the money that they have, the influence that they have, may well be able to, which, you know, what everybody seems to want outside Afghanistan is that the Taliban will display, you know, a new side to themselves, that they will fulfill the promises they've been made, that they're no longer the extremist, violent organization that they were before. They're more open to other groups in Afghanistan, that they want a more inclusive government, and that they will allow at least some women's rights within the limits of what they see as Islamic law. So it's interesting, and it will be, I think, a matter of some time to see how the region kind of deals with it. Certainly not something that any of those countries wanted, but I think they're more prepared than we've been in the West, certainly.
To Lebanon now, and it's taken, gosh, it's been more than a year for the new government to come into place. It's been a very long time. Why is that?
Divisions, really, between the power groups in Lebanon that just weren't able to come together in any meaningful way to get behind the two previous attempts to form any kind of government, even though the urgency has become more and more extreme almost on a daily basis, that the economic collapse and the potential ramifications that we've seen, violence, scattered violence on the streets, medicines, electricity, all of these basics no longer available in any proper kind of way for a country like Lebanon, which, you know, just 2 years ago was really, at least on the surface, doing extremely well. So it's taken that amount of time because these are such deep-rooted rifts within the political elite with the way that Lebanon is run, that it just wasn't possible for any leader, Saad Hariri, who was trying to do that for months and months, failed. Now, Najib Mikati has succeeded in doing this. I think the jury obviously is massively out on what he will be able to achieve, but it is an absolutely vital step for Lebanon to take. It may be too little, it may be too late, but if Lebanon is going to get the help that it urgently needs financially, it has to have a functioning government. The first thing that Mr. Mikati said on Friday when he was able to announce that he'd formed a government was that getting the billions that the IMF has been holding on to, waiting for a government to be in place, waiting for serious reforms to be enacted, that is his priority. And that injection of money is desperately needed in Lebanon. But, you know, it's 50-50 whether Mikati will be able to achieve this. He has a cabinet, again, of some, of people who are there as technocrats rather than as members of the dynasties that have ruled Lebanon for so long, but they're still allied to political parties. There are still groups within Lebanon, Hezbollah obviously being the main one, who exert huge power that can essentially stop reforms taking place. And, you know, it's not just been a year since a government was in place. It's been just over a year since that devastating explosion happened in Beirut, and still absolutely nothing has come out of that inquiry.
Do you feel that Mr. Mikati is the right person for the job? He has experience, and Lebanon's richest man, I know, so I guess there is that kind of power play there. But, I mean, did anyone else step up for it?
Well, not really. I mean, it's been, you know, a game of people just taking their turns. I mean, Saad Hariri had been prime minister before, then Mikati took over, then Hariri, you know, took over again. Then he tried to form his government. Now Mikati is back. I think for ordinary Lebanese, this isn't very auspicious for them to have another billionaire in charge. Is not really what they're looking for. I think many will be hoping that the country can struggle through, that they can survive through until spring next year when elections are to be held. They'll be hoping that this time they'll be able to send a real message to the politicians that change is absolutely essential, and that they'll be able to make some mark at the ballot box. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened in the past. I mean, the hopes have been raised and then they've been dashed. And there is a sense that once again, you know, the Lebanese elite are playing for time here. This gives them a breathing space. But I think after all the history there's been, all the failures that there have been, you'd have to be a little naive. Not that optimism isn't a good thing, but naivety isn't perhaps so great to really have much faith.
Thank you, Sebastian. Sebastian Usher,